From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Singer Joe Williams was one of the reasons for the Count Basie Band's success in the 1950s. Williams is a polished singer of blues and ballads. On today's Fresh Air, he tells of a crisis in his early career when he had to decide between the fast life or the clean life. Also today, we meet French film director Agnès Varda. Her movies include Vagabond and One Sings, the Other Doesn't. In her new movie, Kung Fu Master, her 15-year-old son stars as a boy romantically involved with a 40-year-old woman. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Dells, and book critic John Leonard reviews the novel Life with a Star by the late Czech novelist Jerry Vial. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Singer Joe Williams became famous in 1955 when he recorded the blues song Every Day with the Count Basie Band. By the time Williams joined Basie in 1954, he was already a veteran of the big bands, having sung with Coleman Hawkins, Lionel Hampton, Jimmy Noon, Erskine Tate, and Andy Kirk. Since leaving Basie in 1961, Williams has had a flourishing solo career. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliott once wrote, "Williams is two equally accomplished singers. One is the famous blues singer, and the other is the almost unknown ballad singer." Joe Williams will sing blues and ballads tonight in Philadelphia as part of the Mellon Jazz Festival. And on June 23rd at the JVC Festival in New York, he'll team up with the Count Basie Orchestra, under the direction of Frank Foster, for a special program called Every Day with Joe Williams at 70. Before we meet Joe Williams, let's hear a ballad from his new album, In Good Company. This is How Deep is the Ocean, and it features Henry Johnson on guitar.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? How far would I travel to be where you are? How near is the journey from here to a star? And if I ever lost you, how much would I cry? How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky?
Joe Williams from his new album, In Good Company. Let's talk about how you started singing. Now, you grew up mostly
Chicago.
In Chicago. Your mother was an organist.
Mother played piano.
Oh, piano, okay.
She played piano and sang. Yes.
In the church?
Yeah, sang in the church choir. She didn't play piano in the church. She played at home.
Were you influenced by church music much yourself?
Oh, I loved it, yes. I think the church probably really opened up my ears to classical music as well, because we'd have recitals and concerts and things like that at the church. We used to have theater at the church as well.
So your mother never had any problem with you singing secular music or the pop music of the day?
Oh, no. She used to sing some, too. It wasn't that kind of a household. She used to let me stay awake to listen to Duke Ellington in the 30s broadcast from the Cotton Club, and then kiss me and tuck me in after the band went off. You know, she took me to the theater to see an orchestra there. It was Erskine Tate was conducting the orchestra. And in the band was Louis Armstrong. And I was about 8, 9 years old. And that was one evening, Sunday evening, after church services in the daytime and in the afternoon services, and then we went to the theater. And so she made sure that I heard everything from the Chicago Symphony to the Metropolitan Opera Company coming from New York to all of it.
Do you remember your first time actually singing in front of an audience?
Yes, in front of a band. Yeah, I was nervous, really nervous, too.
What was it? What was the band? What was the
It was a guy named Francois. His name was Francois. He had been in town broadcasting from a club called Dave's Cafe nightly. And he would had finished his engagement in this club and played a ballroom on a Sunday afternoon. And he was looking for a singer. And the fellows, my guys, told me, oh, Joe, you could, you know, sing with that band, only you're afraid. And I went up and sang. I think I did Dinner for One, Please James, or something like that. And the guy wanted me to go with him. He was going to give me $25 a week to go with him. But I think I was about 15 at the time. My mother said, oh, you're going to finish school, dummy. And I said, sure.
Did you finish high school before going on the road?
No, in my senior year, I got a job making about $20, $30 a night at a place called Kitty Davis's, Jackson and Wabash. And that kind of money, I think, dissuaded them to let me do what I wanted to do. I said, he's a man child, and he's in the street, and he's doing it. Let's see how he does it, you know, if he does it, you know. But I always knew that I had the house to come back to, you know, in case I fell on my face.
Now, I had read about you that when you were a sophomore in high school that
doctors
found a spot on your lung,
right,
and they collapsed the lung.
Yeah, pneumothorax is called.
Would you explain that?
Pneumothorax?
Uh-huh.
Well, they puncture, they go between the rib with a needle, and they collapse the lung with gas. I think that's what they did to it now.
And then it got reinflated?
No. Here's what happened. See, while it's collapsed, it's resting.
I see.
And heals. That was the theory, anyway.
What was the practice? What actually happened?
Well, it instead of the spot now, the scar tissue, of course, which might even be stronger than the initial lung itself.
Chicago must have been a terrific place to get started as a singer, because all the bands would pass through there to play, and a lot of the bands came out of Chicago.
Yeah, they all had to come through Chicago to get the stamp, so to speak, you know.
When you were underage, did you find ways to sneak into the clubs to see the bands?
Yes. I was always big for my age anyway, and I was very quiet. And I just wanted to observe. I'd get in a corner someplace and sit down. Club, the owners would come over and sit with me and give me coffee and ice cream and pie and stuff like that, you know. And I'd hear somebody on the stage, and I'd say, oh, gee, I can sing better than that, you know. And they'd say, be quiet and listen, which was good advice. Because you learn many things when you listen. Sometimes you learn what not to do as well.
Singing with a lot of different bands in the 1940s, did you find that the singer had a different role in each band? By that I mean, you know, that in some bands the singers were really important, maybe in other bands they were not considered as necessary. And did the musicians, you were saying the musicians were really supportive of you, were they always that way in the
bands?
Or did they sometimes feel like the singers took attention away from their own musicianship?
I never felt that. Because if you sing like a musical instrument, for instance, you don't try to cover up your support. You sing with the support. In other words, it's a little bit like a drummer. A drummer is supposed to play, just try not to get in the way, is the expression that was used by one drummer, Sonny Greer, who was with the Ellington Orchestra. Try not to get in the way. That's what a drummer's job is for. The musical swing, if you try not to get in the way, and the same thing with a singer. You don't get in the way. You're the soloist. So you can punctuate, make a statement, but you don't get in the way of the music itself. And it gives everybody a chance to contribute. You mustn't ever have someone back there, have a section back there feeling, my part is not important. You know? My part is important, and if it's done subtly, you know, then I have to make room for it so that it's heard, and heard the way they want it to be heard.
Singer Joe Williams is my guest, and in the 1950s, he sang with Count Basie. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes and hear the big hit he had with the Basie Band, Every Day I Have the Blues. Williams has a new album out now called In Good Company. In 1948, I think it was, you had a nervous breakdown.
47.
You spent about a year in the hospital?
Yeah, 47, I think it was, yeah.
What were your symptoms, so to speak? What was going wrong?
Oh, gosh, symptoms now. Well, I didn't want to go out anywhere. I don't think I could get dressed and go out in the street even, you know. Severe depression. And a number of things might have brought it on. But I think it was just trying to decide what I wanted to do, whether I really wanted to do what I was doing or what.
Whether you wanted to sing or not? Or whether you wanted to sing with the bands you were singing with?
Yeah, whether I wanted to sing or what I wanted to do with my life, really. I remember seeing Andy Kirk. I was singing with Andy when this 1946, I guess it was 47. About April of 47, I went in the hospital, it was. And I remember looking at him and saying, my, what an elegant man, you know. And looking around me and seeing these role models that I would like very much to emulate, I thought. And when I realized how they lived and what they did, what have you, I think I began to look inward at myself as opposed to around me, you know. It was like, what is it in Dr. Zhivago? When doctor was asked about living and about dying, he said, well, your consciousness is a light, and, you know, it's like a train going down a track, and it's a light directed to show you where you're going, you know. That's your consciousness. And it's only when you turn the light inward that you're headed for a wreck, you know.
So what was it about the musicians who had been your role models that made you think again?
Well, just the way they looked, the way they were. Clean living, no dope or anything. They were, to me, they were like pristine, you know, squeaky clean and really super type people. And I said, yeah, I think that's the image I'd like to project, you know, instead of a hip street, you can't do nothing for me but give me some money type cat.
And
you know?
Is that what you'd been before?
You know? Well, no, I'd consider you did that as in self defense.
In self defense of what?
Huh? Self defense of what? Well, if you are around people, say women or men, either one, and you don't have anything to speak of, you know. As a defense of not having anything and being embarrassed because you don't have anything, then you beg all the time or put on the facade that I don't want to be bothered by anybody who can't do anything for me. Either one, you know. That's what that was about. I know that I had a lot of things going on I had to straighten out, you know. I decided whether I wanted to be a $2 pimp or $100 trick, you know.
So that's...
Yeah, all of these things you had to settle in your mind because you see all these things happening growing up. You see them happening everywhere. You see them happening downtown in the downtown hotels. You know, you see this life going on and you observe it and you see another lifestyle going on. And you got to make a choice which one really appeals to you. Which one did you really like? Did you feel as though you wanted to relate to or be like? You know, and I made that decision back then, and shut off everything else. And in the midst of it all, went into a severe depression. Because I used to get high every day, of course, you know. And I stopped that, just like that. I stopped that like I stopped smoking cigarettes. You know, like one day I was smoking, the next day I wasn't.
You getting high on marijuana?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, oh yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So when you had this big crisis and figured out you had to decide which direction you wanted to head in, did you check yourself into the hospital? Or?
Mm. No, my wife put me in the hospital. She checked me into the hospital. And I spent a year in diagnostic. They didn't know what to do with me, really. They had no idea what to do with me, I don't think.
Did you feel like
they
you belonged?
They gave me electric shock and insulin shock. And
electric shock must have been in the really experimental stages in 1947.
Oh, I'm a living experiment, from pneumothorax to...
You must have been terrified when you knew you were going to get electroshock therapy.
When you see the people that have had electric shock, then you can have some apprehension. But when you see the other people who had the treatment, you can become apprehensive.
But you hadn't seen anyone yet, so you didn't know what it was you were supposed to be worrying about.
Yeah, I had no idea. Yeah. You know,
well, what effect did it have on you?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, it knocks you out, for one thing. So I don't know what might have happened during the times that I was knocked out. I have no idea about that. But eventually it stopped. They stopped it. And I don't know. It's I was busy observing people around me in there, you know, like, wow. Some people who'd been there for 25 years and stuff, you know, like that. And I could see how easy that was a trap you could fall into, where the state would take care of you and you eat, you know. Food was good. You know, on Sundays you go to church. You go to choir rehearsals during the week. And they had an orchestra in there, a symphony orchestra, a concert orchestra as well as a dance orchestra. And there was, you know, rehearsals and what have you. And I was working with the band there. And it was quite an experience. You know?
When you got out after spending a year in the hospital, did you know with certainty which direction you wanted your life to head in, which kind of musician you wanted to be?
I knew. I knew very well because I knew before I got out because I had a letter from Andy Kirk saying that we had a recording, we'd done a recording. And he said they wanted to start pushing the recording and wanted me to come back with a band. And he offered me $250 a week. That was 1947, it was. And my wife wouldn't sign me out of the hospital at the time. And so I told her and my mother, I don't care if I see either one of you again, you know. Which brings us maybe to the point of nobody loves me, nobody seems to care. Or at least nobody seems to understand what I'm about. You know, because I said before, for 30 years now, the lady I'm with, I mean, we have a great understanding. You know, she does anything she wants, and I'm supposed to pay for it. You know?
Nobody loves me, nobody seems to care. That's a line from Every Day I Have the Blues.
Yeah.
Which was your big hit with Basie
in
1955.
Yeah. But being an only child, you know, and having said to your wife and your mother, you know, like, I don't care if I see either one of you again.
But you did see them, your mother,
oh,
anyway.
Oh, sure. Sure I did, you know.
So you got out of the hospital, played with Andy Kirk for a while.
No, I didn't.
You didn't? Okay,
no, I didn't.
That date never happened.
No, it never happened.
Okay.
Because it was April of 48 before I got out. I went in April of 47 and out in April of 48.
Let me just ask you one more thing about this period. When you got out and you decided that you wanted to be... A musician who was...
A free spirit, really.
And to give up alcohol and marijuana?
No, I didn't give up alcohol.
Oh, okay.
I didn't smoke any more pot.
Okay.
No, I didn't do that anymore, no.
But did you change a lot? I mean, did you change?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think I changed a lot. It was just that I'd made up my mind that, yeah, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to do this. You see, what you have to realize is that when you're isolated or when you're in the hospital, you have a lot of time to think. And one of the things you think about, probably something that young ladies think about very early in life, you know. Well, what the hell now? I've stopped, and everybody else in the world is going on. You know, suddenly, you know, one day you look up and you've stopped, and everybody else is going, everything else is going on, just as if you had never been there, right? Now, how do you relate to a world like this, you know? Take it as you find it, that's all. But it really fixes you up pretty good so that you can get through the grease from that point on, you know.
I want to talk with you more about your music and your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Singer Joe Williams is my guest. He has a new album called In Good Company. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Joe Williams is my guest. Let me skip ahead a few years to when you're singing with Count Basie. This was in, I think, late 1954 that you joined the band? That you
the
actually
day
joined
after
the band.
Christmas.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The day after Christmas of 1954.
Who had been the singer right before you?
Nobody.
He had not had a singer for a few years?
Yeah, that's right.
What made him decide to take you on?
I don't know. He sent for me to come by his hotel in Chicago, and we talked. And he said, I can't give you much or what you're worth, but I can give you something, and why don't you come with me and see what people all over the country think of your work? And as things get better for me, they'll get better for you, you know? And that's all it was. And so he sent me a money order. That was in September. But a week before Christmas, he sent me a money order telegram, and I booked a flight to LaGuardia from Chicago, from Chicago's Midway, and joined the band, and we got together with arrangers named Frank Foster and Ernie Wilkins, and Ernie made Every Day, Frank Foster made The Comeback, and All Right, Okay, You Win, and Every Day I'll Fall in Love All Over Again with You, and most of our things. Teach Me Tonight, Ernie Wilkins made, you know.
Let me ask you about the big hit, the first big hit you had with Basie,
yeah.
Every Day. Was it your idea to record this?
Yeah.
Why did you choose it?
Because I like it.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, he was so funny. Basie said, do you know any of Jimmy's things? You know, Jimmy Rushing, who had been with him in the 30s.
Right.
You know, and the 30s and the 40s, actually, you know. And I said, no, I don't know any. You don't know none of Jimmy's stuff? I said, no. He said, what do you know? Every Day.
Let me play Every Day.
All right.
And this was recorded in 1955. My guest, Joe Williams, and the Count Basie Orchestra.
Every day. Every day I have the blues. Every day I have the blues. Well, you see me worry, baby, because it's you I hate to lose. Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Nobody loves me, nobody seems to care. Speaking of bad luck and trouble, Well, you know I've had my share. I'm gonna back my third game.
Your diction's different when you're singing blues and when you're singing, say, a ballad or a pop standard?
Not really, because if you don't understand the words, you can't, you couldn't enjoy it. I remember when I was singing blues someplace, and Harry Sweets Edison was with me at the time, and he would say, make it plain, and explain it, explain it, you know.
You never had formal vocal training.
No, not really.
As you get older, do you ever wish that you had formal vocal training that would keep your vocal cords in as good shape as possible, or do you know all that stuff anyways?
Know all what stuff?
About how to sing so that it doesn't hurt your vocal cords.
I guess I know. Okay. I don't know.
I mean,
but
your voice
I guess
is
I know.
In, you know, great
I
shape.
I guess I know, yeah. I was wondering why, you know.
Why is she asking me this?
Yeah.
Well, I've just met a lot of singers who didn't have vocal training and who at some point in their career go to a teacher or wish that they had because there's just so much stress that's put on their throat.
Yeah, no, I don't put any stress on me. Stress. I went through all that early. I got rid of all that in 1947. All the stress. Yeah, to do anything that's stressful now, nothing.
Can I ask you one last question?
What?
I notice you're wearing a Jewish star.
That's on one side. On the other side is St. Genesius.
Oh.
The words guide my career.
Uh-huh. What words are those?
Guide my career.
Oh, guide my career. Oh, okay.
Yeah. My wife gave me that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
She's Jewish, or?
No. We just don't take any chances.
I guess that's a good attitude.
Yeah. No.
Joe Williams, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay, Terry.
Joe Williams' new record, In Good Company, is on Verve. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll be joined by historian Simon Chama, author of a controversial new history of the French Revolution called Citizens. Let's get back to Joe Williams' new record. This is Just Friends.
Just friends. Lovers no more. Just friends, but not like before. To think of all we've been and not to kiss again seems like pretending. It isn't the ending. Two friends drifting apart. Two friends, but one broken heart. We loved, we laughed, we cried, and suddenly love died. The story ends, and we're just friends.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. French film director Agnès Varda has always made films about life on the fringes of society. American audiences know her best for her films Vagabond and One Sings, the Other Doesn't. Coming up, Agnès Varda explains her decision to cast her 15-year-old son as the young lover of a 40-year-old woman in Varda's new movie Kung Fu Master. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles The Dells, the vocal group whose hits include Stay in My Corner, There Is, and Oh What a Night. The Dells have been together since 1952. And book critic John Leonard reviews the novel Life with a Star by the late Jerry Vial, who was considered one of Czechoslovakia's most influential writers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush has ordered new sanctions against Beijing. The measures include a ban on high-level contact between U.S. officials and the Chinese government and efforts to block loans to China from international aid agencies. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. is taking the action in response to, quote, reprisals by the Chinese authorities against those who have called for democracy. In China tonight, another leader of the banned pro-democracy movement was arrested. A 28-year-old physics student was one of a list of 21 hunted by the Chinese government. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Beijing.
Chinese television news tonight showed Liao Gong in handcuffs. He's the sixth student leader to be arrested as the crackdown continues on the pro-democracy movement. China's Supreme Court today called for prompt dealings with the 1,300 arrested in the past 2 weeks. 11 have already been condemned to death. Another American reporter was expelled from China today, and Canadian reporter Jan Wong was detained by what she described as three plainclothes security men. Wong, a fluent Chinese speaker, said the three men tried to force her into a car, but stopped when she screamed for help. The Canadian embassy has filed a protest with the Chinese government over the incident. In Beijing, this is Deborah Amos.
The Pentagon today announced that it will begin paying the full cost of the nation's weapons development. Currently, the Defense Department shares the cost with contractors. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said President Bush would have the final say on the step, which was announced by Deputy Defense Secretary Donald Atwood in an interview with The Washington Post. Atwood acknowledged that paying all development costs will force the Pentagon to cancel some weapons in the future as it spends more money to pursue better quality. He said the current policy has led to too many fixed-price development contracts that force companies to cut corners to meet cost limits. In Geneva, the chief U.S. arms negotiator today defended the Bush administration's new proposal on verification. Critics say the call for setting up a verification system even before a new arms treaty is finished will only slow down negotiations. Burton Boleg has more from Geneva.
Reporters here, U.S. arms negotiator Richard Burt insisted the new proposals would not prevent work on unresolved issues in a strategic arms reduction treaty.
And the point I want to make is that in no way will this exercise on focusing on verification and stability detract from our efforts in other areas.
The administration is calling on the Soviets to join in making a special effort to work out the complex verification measures needed to guard against cheating. The administration wants to begin the monitoring and inspections on a trial basis even before the START treaty is completed. Burt said the move would make Senate ratification more likely. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Boleg in Geneva.
Donald Gregg's nomination to become ambassador to South Korea won the full approval of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today. Gregg is the former foreign policy advisor to then-Vice President Bush at the time the Iran-Contra affair began to unfold. During his confirmation hearings, Gregg was questioned intensely about his knowledge of the illegal supply of weapons to the U.S.-backed Contras and whether President Bush was told the details of the operation. Gregg's nomination now goes to the full Senate. Former Georgia Congressman Patrick Swindle was found guilty today on 9 counts of perjury for lying about a money laundering scheme to a grand jury. The 38-year-old Republican served 2 terms in Congress representing Atlanta's suburban 4th District. He was defeated for re-election last November, just days after his indictment. Swindle could receive up to 5 years in prison plus a fine of $250,000 on each count. Sentencing is slated for late August. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 6 points to close at 2473.06. Declines led advances 7-6 on volume of 166 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Most of the harmony groups that started in the 50s had a lead singer and a line of backup vocalists, but the Dells were different. From the beginning and still today, the Dells have been more democratic. They have alternated singing lead, and sometimes that part's even a duet. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of this enduring group.
If you stay, stay darling. You make me oh so proud. Stay, darling, please stay
in my corner. When I hear The Who or The Rolling Stones praised for their longevity, 25 years in the business and still plugging away even if they are creatively sterile, I just have to laugh because the Dells had another hit last year. I forget its title, and it was only a small hit, but hey, the Dells have been singing together since 1952, with only two changes in their lineup. That's impressive. When they first started, the Dells were called the El Rays, all high school buddies in Harvey, a Chicago suburb. In 1953, Chicago met Chess Records, and the El Rays cut a single for Chess before they'd even graduated. Darling I Know was a flop for reasons that may be evident, and Chess dropped them. But the El Rays were serious about becoming professionals and turned for help to Chicago's biggest success story in the vocal group department, the Moonglows. To the group's amazement, the Moonglows taught them everything they could, helped them rehearse, and showed them how to better blend their harmonies. Before long, they'd signed to VJ Records, Chicago's up-and-coming competition to Chess, and had changed their name to the Dells.
Sweet dreams, sweet dreams of
how much the Moonglows helped can be heard on the Dells' first local hit, Dreams of Contentment, which established them as an act to watch. One night, after a party remembered by lead singer Marvin Jr. as consisting of five girls, five Dells, and a bowl of chicken, they sat down and wrote a song about it. Oh, what a night.
Oh, what a night.
But there was dissension in the group over their lack of success, and one of the Dells headed off to Cincinnati to join Otis Williams and the Charms. The group broke up, and one day in 1956, Marvin Jr. was walking down the street when a Cadillac pulled to the curb, and one of his friends in the Moonglows jumped out saying, "You guys have a hit. They're playing it in New York." Sure enough, Oh What a Night had taken off on the pop and the rhythm and blues charts, and the Dells hurriedly regrouped so they could headline a tour. They continued to be successful until a 1958 auto accident hospitalized some of the group, and they took 2 years off while the wounds healed. In 1961, they were back with a very contemporary vocal group sound.
Don't tell nobody that we're in love. And don't tell nobody what we're thinking of. Let's leave nobody.
It didn't do too well, at least partially because VJ was beginning to experience money problems, and by 1965, when they recorded their masterpiece, Stay in My Corner, which we heard at the beginning of the piece, VJ could only keep it on the charts for 4 weeks. In disgust, the Dells signed with Checker, a subsidiary of Chess, which managed to turn a re-recording into a number one hit in 1968.
If you stay,
stay, darling,
stay in my corner.
me oh so proud.
Stay, darling.
In the Checker years, the Dells did the impossible, took the old outmoded doo-wop form and made it into something new that young record buyers who would never have touched Oh What a Night went out and bought. Part of it was due to the genius of Charles Stepney, the greatest non-Motown arranger of the day, who could whip out a monster like There Is. Exploiting their gospel-like rapport with each other, the Dells have continued to move with the times. The last record of theirs I heard sounded a little like Prince could have produced it, but it still sounded like the Dells.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. French filmmaker and screenwriter Agnès Varda began her career 35 years ago, a time when there were few women making movies. Early on in her career, she began exploring women's feelings through her films. In 1958, when she was pregnant, she made a short film about a pregnant woman. In 1961, her film Cleo from 5 to 7 was about a young woman who examined her life thinking that she's dying. Varda is best known in this country for her films One Sings, the Other Doesn't, and Vagabond. One Sings the Other Doesn't explored the 15-year friendship between two dissimilar women. Vagabond was the story of a beautiful, homeless young woman drifting through France. Varda's new film, Kung Fu Master, is about a 40-year-old divorced mother who falls in love with an adolescent boy. I asked Agnès Varda what made her feel she was capable of understanding such a relationship.
I'm a film director, I'm an artist, I'm a writer. I mean, my only work in this life is to be understanding other lives than mine. When I made the film that you called here Vagabond, about a woman bum on the road who ends up dying in a ditch from the cold, I had to be near these bums and these people in night shelters, in stations at night, to not so much be sure I understand them, but to be sure that my work, to reproduce their behavior, reproduce their words, reproduce their relationship, make believe that we feel what they feel. You know, my work is of representation.
Kung Fu Master is adapted from a short story by the actress Jane Birkin, who you had made a movie about. You cast your son in the role of the 14-year-old boy, and that required him doing romantic scenes with Jane Birkin. Did you have any reservations about casting your son in such a role?
That was discussed not only alone, I must say, but with his father, Jacques Demy, who was also a film director. And he was not that thrilled about it, the father, I would say. But when we discussed with the boy, my point was that it is good to act in these ages of complication, of contradiction. Acting is getting out some things that you may not feel, but you are learning to express them. And I felt it wouldn't be that bad for him. On the other hand, I was slightly uneasy on one scene when I had to ask him to kiss Jane. Since mother and father never really know about their kids. You know, I didn't know what our son Mathieu would feel. So I tried to remain a director and ask him to do what he had to do. He knew the scene, you know, and I was trying to keep my distance during the work.
The way to really keep your distance with an actor is to have the relationship be purely a professional one. What are the advantages for you of working with members of your family? And I should say here that your son plays the role of the boy, that Jane Birkin's daughters play the roles of her daughters. So there are several family-related people in here.
Because Jane Birkin wished so much to be herself, look like herself, with her blue jeans, T-shirt, no makeup, in her own house. And her daughter, Charlotte Gainsbourg, has been already acting. Would have been ridiculous not to do it the way she felt. And it allowed me to give a texture of truth, texture of real, like I did in Vagabond.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my son, Mathieu Demy, would also, because I know him so well, be used with a real behavior. All the friends that he had around him in the film were his own friends. When we made the party, I mean, the garden party, they were all young people knowing each other. They could crack jokes, is that a word?
Mm-hmm.
Like, naturally, they could be stupid, they could throw at each other Coca-Cola and drink vodka and look stupid and throw water. They were behaving like they used to do. Obviously, there was a camera, but I spoke with them and said, look, this is a game, you know. And I didn't feel I was doing something else than my job. But, on the other hand, Jane Birkin and myself, we both feel that the beauty of our kids before they become men and women escaping the home is something we'd like to catch before it's gone, you know. So the ephemeral time of their adolescence is something we were very happy to film.
Right, so you have two reasons for,
yes.
for using your family. One is a personal one and one a more filmmaking
yes.
one. Yeah. Okay.
True.
Let me ask you a few things about your past as a filmmaker. You started working in movies in the 1950s. You were in your 20s.
Mm.
And I think that was especially young then for somebody to start directing movies.
Well, besides Orson Welles in the States, very few people could be directors before having been assistant for years and starting around 40. But I was a rebel in my category. I didn't go to the system. I learned not coming from a school, not having been assistant. I made my first film like out of the blue and very violently original. And it was 5 years before the New Wave. This is true. Now I've been being with the New Wave when it was the New Wave time. Then, you know, on my way again. I never go to any group. I'm not a bunch of filmmakers. I do my films the way I feel. And I've been quite consistent on that for 35 years of filmmaking now. Even when I shot in Los Angeles, I was never part of the Hollywood industry system, and I don't wish to be. I don't mean that nobody knows me, but I'm not a commercial success. I'm not a commercial value in the movie industry.
When you started making movies, you hadn't seen many films. Have you since then gone back and caught up on all the films that you missed when you were young?
Well, I've seen a lot of films since. Sure, I mean, I didn't miss them because I didn't see them, so you don't miss what you don't know. Later on, I saw them at the time I was ready to see them, I guess, and when I can go to movies, I love it. I love it. I see old movies, I see new movies, and sometimes even films that I would not like to make. I enjoy them. I'm a good audience, you know. I know I'm a filmmaker. I should be, you know, serious and know how it is made, but I love to be involved and emotional. Even though my film, I try to be distant, sort of Brechtian. I try to make people feel who they are in the audience. I don't want to be taken in a story which take them away from their own life. My work is to try to make them be there, knowing they are in a movie and feeling what would I feel in that situation. And you did ask me the question at the beginning, like saying, what do you think a woman of 40 would feel,
mm-hmm.
or a boy of 14 would feel?
Mm-hmm.
I want them to be involved in the film seeing, like asking themselves the question, would I behave that way? Would I be so vulnerable? Would I be so afraid? And I know that there is something in the film that I believe to be the only real word in love, which is the part of the fear, which is the spine of love, is the fear of losing that love.
On the other hand, you can't help but think that a woman of 40, if she was having an affair with a 14-year-old, would think, this will be fun for a little while, and then I'll go off and find someone my age. Do you know what I mean? That there'd be a certain amount of reminiscing about your own adolescence and nostalgia for it, and then you'd move on to something else.
Well, you are very efficient. You are very realistic. Uh-huh. Maybe a woman of 41 needs a real man. This is not the subject of the film. The subject is there a grace of love related to adolescent feelings which can touch you even when you are 40? And if it is a month or two, it's already something to be able to find again, that grace of being so touched by every moment, so touched by the skin of somebody, and say, I don't want to lose you, when, even though we know it's not a sexual partner that she may need at 41.
Let me rephrase this. I guess I found it a little hard to imagine a woman of 40 being that vulnerable in a relationship with a 14-year-old.
How old are you?
38.
Are you strong?
In some ways I'm strong, and in some ways I'm very weak.
Maybe 39 you will turn
weaker, right?
Because when women reach that age of 40, because of the two numbers, 4 and 0,
uh-huh,
they have the feeling it's a turning point.
Uh-huh.
And I know a lot of women of 40 who had that kind of vulnerability around their 40s. And then they become strong again, and then they have another life because, you know, obviously the life is still ahead of you.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, was the age of 40, was turning 40 an emotional turning point for you?
For Jane Birkin. I made that film for her, you know, because she was so important for her.
But what about you?
I have no bad memory. I don't remember now. I should make it up. Let's say 40 was like 40. 40 would be 68. Certainly was, yes. And the film, it's only a film. Kung Fu Master doesn't tell about my own life. I'm speaking with you because I don't hide my feelings, but has nothing to do with me. I'm a filmmaker, and I have to express stories and emotion of other people, people different of me.
Filmmaker Agnes Varda, her new movie Kung Fu Master opens this Friday in New York and Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight's stories from and about China and Greece and Japan, and also about Bulgaria, the border there with Turkey. Thousands of ethnic Turks are leaving Bulgaria, going into Turkey, after the government there has cracked down on demonstrators protesting against assimilation of the Turks into the Bulgarian society. And from Valdez, Alaska, a story about overcrowding in that small port city, people coming in to help clean up the oil spill. And we'll talk with a judge in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, who has ruled that mules diving into a tank may indeed be a mindless act, but apparently there's nothing illegal about it.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jerry Vial was one of Czechoslovakia's most influential writers, but until now, 30 years after his death in Prague at the age of 59, Vial's work has been unavailable here. With a push from novelist Philip Roth, Vial's novel Life with a Star has been translated into English and published in America. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Life with a Star is another one of those extraordinary fictions Philip Roth keeps finding in Eastern Europe, a precious ore in the collapse of cultures. Roth finds these mineral veins, talks about them, talks publishers into having them translated, and bullies reviewers into reading them with a fire-breathing preface. And he's right again. I'd never heard of Jerry Vial, although Milan Kundera is said to have been influenced by him. I didn't want to read another novel about Jewish victims of the Nazi occupation, especially not in the style of Franz Kafka and Isaac Babel. I'm sorry Vial was a victim of Stalinists as well as Nazis in his native Czechoslovakia, but there are hundreds of books by similar victims that I haven't found time for, not to mention this summer's wonderful new detective novels by Tony Hillerman, Sue Grafton, and Robert Parker. But Roth flogged me on, and a dozen pages into Life with a Star, I was transfixed. Joseph, even the name is borrowed from Kafka, used to be a bank clerk before they made him wear a yellow star. They are nameless, but they occupy Prague, and they ration the marrow in Joseph's stew bones and send him to work in a cemetery and refuse him haircuts and typewriters and musical instruments and require of him a permit to ride the tram on alternate Tuesdays. They arrest people for Beethoven and Hamlet. An acquaintance of Joseph's observes, "They certainly have interesting things to worry about in this war of theirs." Joseph agrees. "They're very inventive," he says. "They don't mind the war at all." He might have escaped to another country with his beloved Rosanna. "But I was a coward," he says. "There always comes a moment when one must make a decision, and all I did was close my eyes and put my fingers in my ears." He is asleep in his own life, in ordinary evil. At first he's even proud. The yellow star has turned him into, quote, "a special person whom everyone looked at and made way for." Later, he wonders why it never occurred to him that it was a bad thing to be an animal in the circus, that pushing a ball with their snouts wasn't something seals normally did, nor dogs walk on 2 feet with hunting caps. All of a sudden, he says, "I knew an awful lot about the circus when I was on the other side of the railing." Cold, alone, smoking tea, Joseph hallucinates. He dreams of the absent Rosanna. He talks to his cat, whose name is Thomas. "You doubt me, Thomas," he says. And maybe Joseph is a Christ figure for the camps. He will also speak in parables about crows pecking at the eyes of martyrs and a magic rake that turns leaves into words. But when at last his summons comes, his transport number, where Joseph really goes, I can't tell you. Somewhere beyond words and numbers, religion and politics, irony and horror, somewhere beyond identity itself. Not a Kafka or a Babel, but Jean-Paul Sartre seems to have written this novel, a nausea about history. Joseph sets fire to the book we are reading. Smoke burns the mind's eye.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Life with a Star by Jerry Vile. Here's a look at the next fresh air. I'll take it. That's the cry of shoppers in pursuit of a bargain. It's also the title of Paul Rudnick's semi-autobiographical novel about a mother and son shopping team. On the next fresh air, we talk about shopping with Paul and his mother, Selma Rudnick. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recital album by Dawn Upshaw, a young soprano who sings opera at the Met and contemporary music with the Kronos Quartet. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Marge Piercy's new novel, Summer People. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.